talk us through your third place bronze medal that you were raving about this morning to me.
Well, actually, my electronic gears died before the start.
Right.
So I had no gears for the race.
First, yeah.
So I was about to get in the car and arrive at Hull, because it's Hillingdon, it's North London, mm-hmm. Northwest London, by Heathrow. So it's a pain to get there. So I sort of legged it out of work as quickly as I could to get there. And then I was about to throw it back. And then actually there was someone there who said, let's just manipulate it into the gear you want. So I sort of thought, oh, fine, I'll have a go. And do you know what? By not having gears, it made me chill out. So I stopped trying to attack. I kind of sat there.
It's a valuable lesson.
Not expecting anything. And then it was a sprint finish. And I was still there and hadn't puffed myself out. So it was good.
Yeah. Good. Congratulations.
It's funny the buzz you get from a really stupid little tiny race. But
we had a golf match on Monday afternoon and it rained incessantly for 4 hours. I've never been so wet in my entire life. But I won, so that was amazing.
Did you?
Yeah, thanks very much.
Well done.
17th green.
What's your handicap?
Mid-detour. It's around 11.
That's good.
In the world, I mean, it's kind of...
Considering you spend most morning meetings hitting the ball, I would have thought it would be a bit better than
that. That's a blatant lie from using every morning meeting.
Not everyone.
No. So we've got quite a bit to talk about. There's lots going on, isn't there?
There's loads going on.
Clients are happy. Portfolio's going up. World's not falling apart.
Makes life a lot easier.
Well, it's definitely easier than it was a year ago, that's for sure.
Yeah. Revised payroll numbers, quite interesting.
Yeah, we've got some charts, so we'll go through that.
Inflation falling away a bit more, but not sort of headline, but underneath the bonnet, there's quite a lot going on, isn't there?
Yeah, no, agreed. Totally agree. So we'll try and get into it.
It's good.
Got the nod from Alex with his sickening tan off the back of his trip to France. And hello, everyone, and welcome to Taking Stock After the Bell, episode 30, joined as always by James Hughes, fresh off his third place in some bike race somewhere, and also delighted to be joined by Poppy Fox, investment manager extraordinaire from Quartz Cheviot. Poppy began her career at Brooks Macdonald after completing a degree in politics and sociology at Durham University, moved to Quartz Cheviot in 2000, and has over 15 years investment experience, similar to James and I guess. Poppy has a particular interest in helping women take control of their finances through every stage of their lives, as well as assisting through lifestyle changes such as bereavement and divorce. She has been nominated for Investment Week Women in Investment Awards on several occasions. Outside of work, Poppy is keen to get outdoors with her dog, Ralphie. She enjoys socialising, can vouch for that, eating out in London life, as well as foreign travel and the odd game of golf and tennis. So how is Ralphie doing?
Yeah, he's very good. Spoiled as always. And I'm definitely one of those people who sort of enthuses that trend of the humanisation of dogs. Pets at home seems to be one of my top stocks.
Did you get him an advent calendar?
Of course.
Of course.
A stocking.
Of course.
Present under the tree. I am that person. I'm not ashamed of it.
Do you take him to Ibiza?
Sadly not. Haven't quite worked out the logistics of that
yet.
He's
a passport now, don't he?
Yeah.
Or is that, we're not allowed to anymore.
He's a little heavy. He got fat shamed at the vet yesterday.
Did he?
He's been told he has to lose a kilogram.
Correct.
Poor lad.
What is it?
He's a cockapoo.
He is 68 kilos. So
oh dear. Classic.
Poor little Ralphie.
Good. And a client's happy generally? Meetings going okay?
Yeah, I think on the whole, things are just so much better than this time last year, aren't they? You know, I know there's lots of things going on and lots of stuff out there, but generally portfolios are looking pretty good year to date.
Yeah,
I think a lot of clients are quite surprised, aren't they, bearing in mind what's going on in the world.
And I think you read the news and it always sounds really negative, but actually when you look at what's happened in markets this year, portfolios, more positive than last year.
I think the best resolution that anyone can do is not to watch the news,
yeah.
Particularly the news at 10. I mean, if you watch the news at 10 before bedtime...
That's so killing your sleep for the night, isn't it?
I'm in bed by quarter to 10, so
I'm
way too late. I
know. Come to the dads over here. So we've got a chart on screen of the ARC private client indices that we use as sort of peer group comparators, 12-month chart, and they've got three categories shown on here. Steady growth, equity risk, and balanced. The names are sort of are what they are, but you know, essentially the sort of riskier portfolio equity risk is up about 9% over 12 months. probably about 4 or 5% year to date, I suppose, from the start of January. Steady growth up a little bit less, about 7% in 12 months, and balanced about 5.5-6%. So that's probably kind of weirdly kind of in line with long-term averages is what we'd expect portfolios to do. But you can, you know, these indices bottomed in October, November last year, having sort of gone down a lot in 2022 and had a pretty mediocre start to 2023. And then it's been the last 6 months back to the races, right? Which I think's good. And I'm just sort of roll it on whilst I'm still talking. And it's a selected asset class performance year to date. Here we've got global equities in yellow, up about 9%. UK equities up about 7 and a bit percent. The interesting thing here about the UK is it was sort of lagging global equities quite widely in sort of February, March time. It's had a really good month or two, and global equities have sort of rolled over a little bit, and perhaps I want to talk about that in a minute. Bonds, gilts, bonds, corporate bonds, and property still kind of flat to slightly down year to date as the impact of kind of higher rates still continues to sort of feed its way through the system and the headwinds that those provide. But, you know, generally speaking, assets doing what we would want them to do, and we've had a little bit of a setback in the last month or so. What do you reckon, Husey?
Corporates have been pretty resilient, haven't they? I know they're slightly, considering what rates expectations have done.
Yeah.
They've held up a lot better, haven't they, than gilts on a relative.
Yeah.
I know gilts have had quite a pop, haven't they, in the last few weeks.
Yields.
That's on inflation numbers and rate expectations. The Pell come out, well, we sort of had rates are going to stay higher for longer, and then we've had a bit of a change again, haven't we?
We have. So we've got that chart here. So if we move on to this. So the blue line here shows what the market is pricing for rates today, and the yellow line is what it was 3 months ago. And we can see that today rates are, you know, higher for longer, in inverted commas. So in December 2024, we can see markets now pricing rates to be just under 5%. So was that one or two cuts this year?
Yeah.
Whereas at the start of the year, markets were expecting kind of 5 or 6 rate cuts and to rates to be 3.5-4. So
it's a big shift, isn't it?
It's a massive shift. Had you told me in January that instead of 6 rate cuts, there would be none or one, you'd have said the equity market would be pretty weak. But it's been quite resilient, right?
Mm-hmm. Seems to have held up well, considering we've had this sort of shift in sort of expectations, and it almost looks like it's getting even harder to predict, isn't it? I just feel like the data is sort of almost... Yeah.
It's always one of the interesting things about markets, though, isn't it? Even if you predict a macro outcome such as COVID or inflation or whatever it might be, you don't always get how the market's going to react, and therefore you can't always make money because it's not obvious.
I wonder how much of this is on NVIDIA.
What, rates or the market?
No, the kind of what equity indices are doing, because NVIDIA had those amazing numbers, didn't they, in
February,
which really sort of kept momentum going with the AI trend. I wonder if NVIDIA disappoints the knock on to the rest of the market, how much importance there is on that one stock. Obviously the UK's, I don't know if you've got a chart, but the reasons for the UK ticking up, we're obviously driven by a few sectors.
Yeah, we've got the oil price here, which will just pop up now. So the oil price year to date has gone from kind of 75, got up to kind of 90, and it's come back a little bit. Sort of Middle East tension and that sort of thing. And that always helps the UK market on a relative basis, isn't it? Still not back to anywhere near we were in the sort of Ukraine war highs of $120, but certainly definitely higher than it was. And that in part has kind of helped the UK market in the last month.
But the big change is, I mean, not just oil, it's been the animal spirits back on in terms of M&A. We had Dark Trace.
Talk me through it.
Yeah. From Thomas Bravo.
Thomas Bravo, private equity,
Yeah, we've had Anglo American, which looks like it's being dual bid for, or BHP initially, and now potentially Glencore is the
rumour, isn't it? Said to be interested, allegedly.
And then DS Smith.
DS Smith, of course.
Continuing
and that's
the got
that's got
that.
Really interesting, hasn't it? Because obviously it was Mondi and International Paper. It looks like International Paper have won that battle, but now the speculation that International Paper have been bid for by a Brazilian outfit.
Yeah, who I've never heard of.
No, I haven't either.
So you've got a bid.
Bet it wasn't just me then.
No.
You you've got a bidder who's being bid for, so I don't know what that does to the share price. But when we've talked about the UK market quite a lot, and clearly there's massive pockets of undervaluation or perceived undervaluation.
The pressure on us, it'd be interesting to hear your take as well from, you know, someone that's not in here regularly, but John and I, we're under, it feels like every week there's more and more pressure for us to not have the UK or to have less of it. Have you had the same from your clients?
Yeah, or? I think it's been a theme over the last few years, hasn't it? It's like, why are you not putting more in the US? Why are you not looking at today's tech stocks as a great sell market? But I think 2022 showed us why you shouldn't dismiss the UK market. Actually, it has a slightly, you know, it has quite a different makeup to US markets and other parts of the globe.
So it's, I think, a great in part of a
diversified portfolio, you want that skewed to the UK, I think.
I mean, it's funny, I was listening to a podcast the other day, and they were saying, you know, actually how markets move in tandem, and you know, the S&P has got such a low exposure now to oil and gas compared to where it, you know, what it did have 30 years ago.
I think the numbers, I think in the mid-noughties, 2000, when we all started...
It was like 35% or something, wasn't it?
18%, I think, energy was of the index. Yeah. It's now 5%. Yeah. And the UK still got, I think, BP and Shell combined are like 13 or 14%. And that's significantly higher than everywhere
else. But the commentator on his podcast was saying there's nowhere, you know, there's no indices you can buy that would give you that oil exposure. And I felt like writing in saying, well, what about the UK? It's really important on a global basis.
And I think in this sort of ESG world, we've got to be careful not to completely sort of dismiss those, you know, the likes of BP, Shell, good income yield, you know, what they can give to a portfolio.
Do many clients ask you about BP and Shell specifically and about energy transition, ESG, climate change?
I wouldn't say a huge amount. You get the odd conversation, but I wouldn't say it's sort of particularly mainstream in my client bank personally.
And I wonder if that's a demographic thing, if that's the sort of generation of clients that we're dealing with, typically older, somewhat less attuned, I guess, to the issues of climate change. I wonder if if you were to sort of map it.
I think when we did the last quantitative survey, it showed that the clients who are younger and the clients with the much larger portfolios, i.e. the people who really were sort of thinking about what legacy they're going to leave, were the ones who are more interested in the ESG.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Whereas actually, I'd say our sort of mainstream client, it's perhaps not as high on their agenda as some other people.
Yeah, it's more about making sure the income is there every month.
Yeah, and that's thing, we've got a lot of clients who are taking income and relying on our portfolio. Yeah. So actually, I think, again, yes, it's great to have some US, but you don't get much income yield necessarily from those stocks. So having the balance is a useful tool.
That's quite an education piece, isn't it? Saying to clients, you know, we your requirement is a standing order of, say, £2,500 a month, but it's not all going to come from dividends. Some of it's going to come from growth, and we need to manage.
And I find quite a lot of clients, you know, getting that across, the whole concept of total return, that's definitely an education piece. But I still think, particularly in times of, sort of market turbulence, that sort of defensive equity income yield is really useful.
Definitely is, yeah.
Yeah, I think the resources side of the UK market definitely gives it something. I think, you know, what should a UK domiciled resident client, how much of their equity allocation should they have in the UK versus the rest of the world? And the UK makes up 3% of global equities. Should a UK client have 3% of their equities in the UK? Probably should have more. Mm. What is the right number? 30%? 50%? I don't know. When we started, it was probably most of it, right?
Yeah, definitely much higher than the US component. Yeah. And it's been that shift over the sort of, 15, 16 years I've been doing this, that, you know, reducing that UK, increasing that US and global.
Yeah, I think we were predominantly UK. The way we'd think about it was...
But I think, again, it's that move from that sort of stockbroker model to the sort of discretionary fund management model, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, no, totally.
And I think having Coutts just, or Schroeder's just, no, it was Coutts, wasn't it?
They've announced. Yeah, very noteworthy. So
selling almost £3 billion.
Yeah, so in their managed portfolios, which I think they've got about 15, 20 billion in those managed portfolios, they're taking the equity weight of their typical portfolio from 25% to 3%, which is going to involve selling billions, I was 3 to 4 billion. Worth of UK equities.
Well,
the strangest thing about that announcement was that they pre-announced what they were going to do, so they hadn't done it yet, and they actually gave a window of when they were going to be selling, which I there must have been a reason why they did that.
Because
why would you pre-announce? Yeah. I mean, it's not dissimilar to Gordon Brown announcing that we're going to sell all our gold. gold price probably tanks, and we sell it, and it goes up again. But that was noteworthy, actually, how they're making that change. And there are like things that ring the bell at the top or the bottom, and I just wonder in hindsight if that will be one of them.
I mean, from when it's announced, the FTSE's gone in one direction.
It has.
So let's hope they're out and it's all sold.
Back over 8,000.
We need to get some... That was quite a...
That was quite a big moment. Yeah. Well, it was one of the first podcasts, wasn't it? The FTSE went through 8,000 briefly.
We jinxed it, didn't we? We said the FTSE's back.
What we should actually do is get FTSE 10,000 hats made, because we'll obviously be there by the end of the year. Just another 20%.
That's not advice, by the way.
No, that's definitely not advice. Not a solicitation to buy or sell. Now, if we just sort of move on to some of the macro data, that, I mean, as you sort of alluded to, James, it has been quite interesting. So we've got a chart of inflation here, UK in blue, Europe in grey, both continuing their downward trajectory. Yeah. The one to sort of note here is the US in orangey yellow, which has sort of got stuck at 3.5% for the last 2 to 3 months. And to be fair, it's not much higher than what expectations were in terms of the month on month. But it does appear to have kind of got somewhat sticky, which is mainly the reason why interest rates expectations have kind of been pushed out. Do we think that this kind of stickiness continues, or is this
we had payroll numbers revised, didn't we, for March and April, downwards?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've just picked something up here, and he's made some good points actually, which is, on the rental side, a lot of it rolls this summer.
Summer.
Yeah, so that's a lot of that's coming out. The other one is motor insurance, which will start rolling in a few months. And then there's gas prices.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the point he's making is there were a lot of components that were very inflationary in the data. Actually, those number of components have really started to get smaller. And actually, a number of those components, you know, because obviously inflation is measured on a year-on-year basis,
yep.
We are going into those higher pricing levels, which are comparable,
yep.
You know, and on a comparable basis, haven't moved much from a year ago. So I think the rent one was always the component. Remember, last year we talked a lot about rent in the US, and I think that comparison gets harder, or it's easier, you know, yeah, it's easier. Come the summer. So right. I think my instinct is actually inflation in the US doesn't remain quite as sticky as the market thinks at the moment. I think it does start to roll. And I think those non-farm payrolls being revised is quite interesting. The other thing he's mentioned is around actual employment, the full employment numbers falling slightly, isn't it? And when there's a divergence between non-farms and that full employment number, that's usually a good sign the economy's slowing.
Okay.
I think it's also with inflation, it's working out what's going to be almost like the new normal in this sort of, you know...
If you can tell us that number, Pops, that would be wonderful.
But three and a half, it's obviously a lot higher than it has been if we look at the average over the past 15 years. But is it that high? You know, where's it going to land, both in the sort of UK and US?
I mean, it depends on what...
Yes, if I had that crystal ball, I'd let you know.
That'd be great. I think the other interesting point is we can... You know, the Bank of England policy can be different to the Fed's policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actually, we're... You know, us and you know, the UK and Europe are now in a different position to the US. And it's whether, you know, actually our central bankers should start to act based on the economy they're thinking about, as opposed to being obsessed with what the US is
doing. What the Fed's
doing. Yeah, and I think
there's a slight currency kind of concern, isn't there?
If we start cutting
rates and the US are holding, if not putting rates up, then sterling's going to get...
Yeah, naked. And also, if sterling collapses, we'll start importing inflation again. Mm. I know that's of concern, but, you know, also, as we're all very aware, there is a lag to this stuff. You know, I think there's a good argument for saying we should have cut already, because we'll only, you know, when the data comes through, it's almost too late.
That's always been the problem for central banks, though. They're between a rock and a hard place, and
timing
of it is near on impossible.
Yeah, they were too late putting rates up to begin with, and they were too slow to recognise the problem, and that's know, that's not me trying to sound clever that was obvious all along. That's just kind of the way of the world, yeah. Right? And I think you're right, James. I think there is a chance that they are too late. Talking of those kind of unemployment figures, those non-farm payrolls, we've got the kind of monthly change here, and we had payrolls last Friday, and you can just see this final bar on the end here was quite a bit softer than what was expected. And you can, you know, I've actually cut the axes off this chart because this March or April 2020 was like a minus 17 million or 1.7 million. It was just off, it just made the chart look silly, so I cut the axes off. But you can sort of see the trend line since through mid 2021. It softens, you know, it does soften quite nicely. And then on kind of on the unemployment figures here again, UK is in blue and US is in blue, is in yellow. It is sort of ticking up a little bit, but still pretty low, really. You wouldn't say there was like flash warning signs there.
No.
And I think it's almost been at surprisingly low rates, considering the sort of interest rate changes we've seen over the last sort of 18 months, two years.
I think if you're a central banker and you were in the US, this would be quite pleasing to see US unemployment kind of rising slowly, because I know it was announced last year that, you know, we'd seen peak inflation and essentially the top was called, but this is some evidence, isn't it, that the economy is slowing down. I just think they've got to be really careful on not slowing it too much.
Yeah, and then final chart on the labour market, we've got a chart on wage growth here as well. So the blue line is the US this time, and the yellow line is the UK. And you can see that blue line, US wage growth, is moderating from kind of 6-7% in 2023, and we're down at below 5 today. And that, you know, that number is, so again, more evidence that the wage, the labour market is slowing a little bit. The UK numbers are somewhat distorted because there's quite a lot going on in the data, but that number is coming down as well, still a bit higher at 6%. But, you know, on the wage growth side of things, you know, one thing that we talk about, why hasn't the economy fallen over? People's wages are now growing at a faster rate than inflation. Yeah. So they should be better off month on month. Yeah, there's a sort of element of catch up, definitely, after a period where wages weren't growing as quickly as inflation.
Although I've just seen my Strava subscription has gone from £9 a month to £17.
Ooh,
no, it wasn't Strava, so it was Zwift.
That's quite a big up.
Yeah.
Well, my mother reported last night that a steak in the Farmers Club has gone from £28 to
£42. Ooh, my dad won't be happy.
I know. So that was quite a price of beef, obviously, has been pretty firm. But that's what's happening, isn't it? So
it's tough in the Raymond household.
So I think that the takeaway is inflation is moderating, should continue to moderate. The labour market is softening. There's maybe a risk that if the Fed don't cut, you know, maybe it begins to soften a bit too quickly and too much.
The other thing is a cut. Isn't there a stat that there's never been a cut in the Fed's fund rate within two months before an election?
Oh, well, yeah. So,
I mean, that's the thing. We're getting ever closer to that election date.
How are they going to manipulate the sort of central bank versus politics?
Do we have to talk about politics?
Well, we're getting closer.
Right.
We can try and avoid it, but it does seem to be up there in the top five topics of conversation.
No, you're right.
It?
Because I need to get out more, I actually spent last Wednesday watching Powell's press conference and the Q&A, and he was asked about around the election, and he was pretty unequivocal about it. It was like, we don't care about the electoral cycle. We've got our mandate, and we will make our decisions accordingly. He was quite adamant and quite firm about it. But yeah, they will definitely bear that in mind, I think.
Yeah, I do have a concern that they're going to cut too. I know there's lots of people saying the US consumer is just not as sensitive to rates as they once were.
But like the Hughes household.
Fixed a nice low rate.
Didn't really enjoy the chat about UK mortgage rates going up again last week. Could do without that.
Yeah, I've not got a worry until October 26th, so we'll be
lucky
fine.
You.
Have you got a refi looming?
Currently on a 5.56% tracker rate, not particularly pleasant, if I'm totally honest.
No.
Curtails Ralphie's Christmas presents, isn't it?
Ralphie.
I'm sure Ralphie's
won't be getting the usual Pets at Home order this year.
Ralphie's got some weight to lose, so he could do without some
treats. Less treats. No organic ones anymore for him.
Oh, getting violent now. And then just sort of on the sort of interest rate side of things, bond yields, got a chart here of UK and US bond yields. This is the 10-year UK in blue again, US in yellow. They've sort of ticked back up a bit, haven't they, this stuff from the start of the year. So UK 10-year got down to 3.5% at the start of the year, 4.25% roughly today. I had a presentation this morning from Bond legend Richard Woolnough, who's got his 20-year anniversary in charge of the M&G Corporate Bond Fund.
Impressive.
It's quite interesting.
It's quite a small fund, that, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, 30 billion.
It's how big is 40 billion?
All in, I think, all of his funds are 30, 40 billion. And he was sort of saying that, you know, you should get 2% for inflation and 2% for growth, so you should be getting 4%. So if you're getting 4.5%, actually, that's quite attractive relative to what you,
I mean,
you know,
again,
how he thinks about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, again, not advice, depends on time horizon and strategy, etc. But if you're looking at what yields are doing versus how equities have performed over the last, well, from October, I mean, if you were all equities, this has got to be, you know, surely there is an argument to say trim some equities and take advantage of these yields, because as we know, over the long term, equities go from bottom left to top right, but obviously, you know, it's impossible to time markets, but these yields are quite attractive now, aren't they, based on where inflation is.
What are the, Poppy, what are the conversations you're having with kind of newer clients in terms of sort of risk reward, balanced growth, conservative, you know, is there a sort of, have you seen a shift in terms of what clients are?
I wouldn't say a shift, but it's still having to almost sort of try and convince people to take enough risk for quite a lot of the clients I'm taking on, you know, the ones that aren't the sort of seasoned investors in your portfolios. So actually trying to explain to them, if you've got that long-term time horizon, you want to have a, you know, a good 65-75% equity exposure, in my opinion. But actually saying, you know, bonds and sort of gilts, etc., are arguably more attractive than they have been in the past sort of 15 years, and having it. It's going back to that. I know we overuse it in this industry, but diversification.
Yeah.
But I'm, yeah, there's been a few people recently just having to sort of, because there's so much negativity out there, convince them to actually take that equity risk. Because if you don't need the money tomorrow, you've got that 5-year time horizon, take it on.
Yeah.
It's amazing, actually, that yields at the end of the year were that low.
Yeah, they fell. I mean, that was, if you remember, as we sort of said earlier, you know, markets are pricing 6 rate cuts in 2024, weren't they, back in December. And the 10-year got
down to 10-year gilt got to 3.5.
3.5, yeah, it did. And it's funny how our mindset shifts over time. 3.5 now seems low.
Yeah.
When it bottomed at 0.1% in August 2020. Yeah, yeah. We can't, you know, we would think that 3 would seem low from here, wouldn't it? And this is that sort of behavioural bias, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's
anchoring back,
you know,
to.
We've had 15 years of bonds being completely out of favour. So actually, it's that sort of slight mindset shift to relook at them in a slightly different light.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I've seen with clients to a degree, is clients whom were cautious, conservative, with a lowercase c, generally investors, having been pushed out the risk spectrum, having to buy equities because bonds were yielding 0 or 1. And for those clients, particularly if they're retired and they want a bit of income and they want, you know, they don't want to worry about the stock market meltdown on the front page of the Daily Mail, for those clients, conversations are a lot easier to say now, right, well, we can bring you back down the spectrum, not massively, not selling all our equities and buying bonds, but definitely for those clients, bonds are now an option.
There's more scope in those lower risk portfolios now, isn't there?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and that's really good for those lower risk clients.
Just there gives us a lot more optionality across this piece. And I totally agree with you. For those with 5+ time horizons who are younger, then they should be having mainly equities, because equities should do better over, should do better than 4.5%.
Yeah. And again, not a prediction, but history will show that it will pay off in the over the longer term.
Probabilities on your side, for sure. We weren't going to talk about politics, but Husey, you want to talk about the US budget deficit, and sort of leads us nicely on from bonds, actually, because, you know, one of the kind of, why might you be worried about buying government bonds? Well, we've got loads of debt, haven't we? And that debt pile's growing. So this is the three charts here. This is the current US budget deficit, so the annual deficit, and it got down to 15% of GDP in the pandemic. It recovered a bit, but it's not recovering that much, and the US government are still spending 6% of GDP more than they are earning in revenues. So clearly, if you're, you know, if you're running a deficit, then your overall debt is going up. So this chart here is the total stock of government debt as a percentage of GDP. And it's at 100, just shy of 120%, having been kind of 50 at the turn of the millennium. Obviously, it went up in the recession, financial crisis, went up again in COVID. And the UK number, look, the chart looks similar, but the UK number is, I think, just below 100, isn't it, percent of GDP.
Yeah.
And the deficit in the UK is not quite as big in the US. But if you take those two charts and put them together, you basically get this chart here, which is how much does the interest on that debt cost? And in the US, that's now 4.5% of GDP. So they spend 4.5% of GDP on just the interest on the debt, which is as high as it's been since 1990. And is, I think, US government spend more on interest on debt than they now do on defence.
Yeah, they do. Yeah.
I think both those charts are quite stark, aren't they, when you see it on the screen?
I mean, it's really difficult because you could get really bearish on debt levels and quite obsessive on, you know, the interest payments and you know, and someone could take a view and not have any exposure to risk. But it's not a problem until it's a problem. You know, it's all the time they're issuing. You know, the US government is issuing debt and there's buyers for it. It's not an issue. I mean, Japan got to over, did it get to over 200%?
250%, I think they are.
Yeah, so, you know, there are examples of governments being able to still operate with larger percentages of GDP. But again, that's in a lower rate environment at 4.5%. You know, the interest payments are hugely meaningful, and that's, you know, this is without a potential presidential change as well, where, you know, again, we don't really want to talk about politics, but the likelihood is, you know, Trump is usually, or in his last term, he was certainly, you know, quite keen on growth and cutting tax rates and things,
yeah,
which could theoretically balloon this more, and it is. You know, it is that point of when do people start worrying about it? I think from the meetings we've had recently, I think the US budget deficit and you know, percentage of you know, debt as a percentage of total GDP is being talked about a bit more.
Yeah. But not by the politicians. It seems to me that both parties in the States don't really.
It's just being ignored.
Yeah.
They're slightly burying their head in the sand.
Yeah, and it's. You know, I think it's, as you said, John, they're spending more on interest payments than they are on their defence budget. And I mean, that is, politically, surely, that becomes an issue at some stage.
Yeah.
And I saw a, we had a strategist on recently, didn't we, who had a chart for the amount of debt issued and what US equities have done, and it's almost performed entirely in tandem.
Right.
I think it was Jonathan Stubbs from
Berenberg.
Yeah, which is really interesting. And he's not saying that's the reason why, you know, that's not the reason why US equities have done so well, but it's a very similar
amount of debt. The deficit means that people have got more money to spend.
Yeah, so his point was the amount of debt issued as a percentage, almost that number was the exact amount that the S&P has grown by. In market cap terms,
right,
and of course there's big differences, but you know, actually, by having a more stimulative policy and encouraging growth, you know, is that the reason why U.S. equities have done? You know, one of the reasons they've done so well, because they can't keep issuing debt as a percentage of GDP in the way they are. At some stage, you know, they can't keep having a deficit. It's got to be equalised or neutralised at some stage, isn't it?
I mean, the US is the US, and they have the dollar, and they are the de facto kind of global reserve currency. If we just come back to the chart on 10-year government bond yields, and if we look at around September 2022 with a blue line, the UK spikes right up. Now, that was the trust budget.
That's a trust moment,
which was the unfunded tax cuts and spending commitments on the energy price cap, etc. But the bond market said, no, hang on a minute, we're not doing that because we're not going to, you know, we're not going to buy your debt. You had kind of mass sell-off of UK government bonds that, that was a week in my career, that was pretty savage, and they ultimately had to unwind that. So I think what could happen in the US? Well, it's less likely to happen in the US because it's the US and it's a dollar.
But it could.
But it could,
theoretically, it could.
Yeah, and maybe the bond market needs to do that for the politicians to kind of get the message. Mm. I don't know. That's a sort of.
Let's hope they don't
theory.
Do that in the US, though.
I mean, the good thing for US corporates is there's lots of debt. Most global companies have lots of debt issued in lots of different currencies. Mm. You know, match liabilities against assets. You know, they've got different trading hubs, they'll have local debt issues. So it's, yes, of course, it will be an issue for corporates, but, you know, on the whole, the businesses we're invested in will be able to manoeuvre around it. But as you say, it will be, you know, I mean, Truss obviously lost her job. You know, if it happened in the US, the same could very easily happen.
Mm. No, I think it's, I think that's definitely something to sort of keep an eye on. People are talking about it. The market knows about it. Mm. And it's this thing, you know, what's in the price? Well, you don't really know what's in the price, but it's not something that no one's talking about and people are ignoring within markets, certainly. That the politicians, I'd argue, in the States don't really seem to have cottoned on. I mean, the Republicans traditionally have been quite hawkish on the deficit, but they don't seem to be at the moment because Trump wants to cut taxes again when he, you know, if he gets elected. Did I say when? if he gets elected.
Is that a prediction?
No, done deal whatsoever. So I think, yes, it's definitely something to keep an eye on, but it's and probably quite worrying. I mean, interestingly, in the UK, the deficit is somewhat more under control.
Mm.
Interest payments are quite a lot higher than they have been. I should really put the chart up, but it's nowhere near as high as 4.5% of GDP in the UK.
Is that because is our debt issuance much longer?
Yeah, so we've termed out our debt in the sense that we've issued longer-dated bonds that don't need refinancing. The US seem intent on issuing very short-dated paper bills, 6 months, 9 months bills, which have to roll over much quicker, so they feel the impact of higher interest rates.
It's also why their tips weren't nearly as volatile or didn't fall nearly as much as our linkers. Because I think the duration is much shorter in the US, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's a much smaller percentage of the market as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, it's a sort of fascinating picture at the moment, really, isn't it? I mean, you know, portfolio is broadly healthy. We can get 4-5% on bonds. Equity market's doing okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
We're just waiting for something to go wrong, right?
I think it's interesting.
Always something to worry about.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked about it a lot in terms of wanting more breadth of returns from markets, and we are getting that. I mean, those seven names haven't been as powerful over the last few months as they have done over the last year. There are returns being generated, or there is performance coming from other sectors, which I think is really important for the market. Certainly, it means our job as active managers is better, and there's certainly more opportunity for us to outperform when the names aren't as narrow.
And a lot of clients are asking about politics and elections and stuff. I mean, what are you sort of saying to them, Poppy, about, you know, should we be worried about a Labour government and are they going to take my portfolio away?
It's interesting. I'm finding at the moment clients are asking more about the politics than the sort of, you know, underlying stocks, what's in the portfolio, because it's just obviously half the globe are going to the polls this year. Mm-hmm. I suppose I'm saying I don't think whichever party gets in, I mean, I think it's pretty unlikely to be the Conservatives, but it'll be negative for the economy and markets. I suppose we've got to wait and see what happens on a personal finance basis if Labour gets in. I think that one might be something to sort of look at. But my view is we cross that bridge if and when we come to it. We can't sort of speculate and we can't make changes when we don't know. You know, Labour are keeping their cards so close to their chest, we don't actually know what their sort of manifesto is at the moment. So it's a slight case of wait and see.
We had our weekly investment strategy recently, didn't we? And Karen, our CIO, gave some data around elections and how equity markets perform. I think, I can't remember the exact numbers, but on the whole, elections do very little, certainly over the mid to long term, in terms of, unless there's, you know, real specific policy changes that, you know, directly impact investments.
I think Labour are much more business friendly, they're much more in tune with the city than perhaps they have been in the past, so that's got to be a positive.
I mean, there's always some kind of sector worries. You know, in the US it's always been around healthcare. You know, that's healthcare, an easy one for them to attack. But I think healthcare it feels like it'll be largely left alone this time, as you say, tech and regulation monopolies, maybe.
Maybe in the UK, the house builders and maybe the banks, they're going to sort of clamp down a bit on the banks and bankers' bonuses and that sort of stuff. You know, you get these kind of little tremors have come up, or, you know, I always think about BT and what the government forced them to do in terms of putting fibre down and how much they have to spend each year. And that makes quite a big difference on the share price and their returns long term.
Well, it hasn't been great for shareholders as a result of what
the regulators
have done.
So, yeah, I know all clients are asking about it, aren't they? But I think you're right on the personal finance side, we just don't know. So making any bold decisions with your own, you know, to give a load of money away because you're worried about IHT just because it might be a Labour government who might do something, I think is probably a bit...
I think on the UK, the market has more or less priced a change in government. Mm. So I think if there is a change in government, there's probably less... In reality, there'll be less reaction to it.
Well, it's the opposite of Brexit, right? And pre-Brexit, the polls were such that we probably were going to remain, and therefore sterling was 150, 160. We had a shock result, and sterling falls from, I don't know, what, 120, 130 on the day. And, you know, because it was a surprise, there's no one out there that doesn't think that Labour can win that election. So, you know, to come back to this point about what's in the price, well, I'm pretty sure it's already in the price. And I think you're right. I think that the city see Labour as a very different outfit to the sort of Jeremy Corbyn manifesto last night.
Well, certainly a more central left party to a hard left that was the, you know, we had the potential for last time. Again, on the US side, you know, I think, you know, last time Trump was elected, the market fell 6% on the day in complete. Actually, I think at one stage it fell through, tried to fall through 10%. There was a trading halt, but actually, within 2 days, it had clawed back.
Yeah, those things often are very short term, aren't they? It might be a short term fall, but by the next week, it's almost a blip.
So again, it's kind of, you know, exciting to watch from the sidelines. We do very little because we're long term.
Talk about it.
Yeah, and they do say a week is a long time in politics. So who knows what will be by November?
It certainly is for mistrust anyway. So. Actually, there was a talking of podcasts. There's a great Robert Peston has just done a podcast on. five episodes on who killed Liz Truss.
Oh, really?
It's really interesting. And they interview Liz Truss at the end. And there's a lot more going on in terms of some Bank of England announcements. It's
Is that why she thought
Did you read her some of the extracts from her diary?
She's just released a book, hasn't she?
I read a few of the extracts, and it's quite interesting, you know, whether it's true or not, but how she's talking about all these people in the background almost, you know, setting her up to fail, out to get her.
Yeah, it's...
Clearly she's a politician, so you've got to slightly
take... There's a lot of conspiracy theories on it, but it's if you've got some time, it's well worth listening to, Who Killed Liz Truss. It's quite interesting. He does it quite well. I'm not necessarily a massive fan of Robert Peston, but he actually does this quite well.
Listen.
You should do on your tube journey.
any closing thoughts from either of you about anything else that's going on?
No.
I don't think so.
Sell pets at home.
After
try and
let Ralphie's on his diet.
Try and we should have a sweepstake on the next UK stock that's going to be bid for, because it's only a matter of time, isn't it?
I mean, these are not small companies that are being bid for. I mean, the 250 has always been lively, but these are, you know, Anglos and DS Smith. These are
Massive, dark trades.
These are proper companies. It's funny, everyone bemoans the situation after, but as our tech analyst has sort of pointed out, you know, dark trades have been criticised for years from investors and shareholders, and weren't given the support that they probably should have done. And as a result, they've been bid for, and now after the event, everyone's saying we've lost another crown and a jewel, but actually, I think that's investors' fault in the UK.
Yeah.
We didn't support that company.
No, and that's why IT is what, less than 1% of the UK market, because these businesses don't get enough of a helping hand from London in general, and they want to migrate to the NASDAQ. And I sort of reflecting on the chat we had with Tom Slater at Scottish Mortgage, you know, if you look down what Scottish Mortgage has in its portfolio, and again, this is definitely not investment advice, you know, if that was listed in the US with a broadly US shareholder base, it wouldn't be on a 10% discount to its NAV. It would be on a big premium because it's got ByteDance, because it's got, you know, SpaceX, because he's got all these interesting
businesses.
It's got Northvolt,
the battery business, which is phenomenal.
Because he's got all these, but they have to do a buyback to try and close the discount because that's what shareholders in the UK want, which is sort of feels kind of the wrong way around a bit. But maybe that will change in time. Maybe we'll, you know, rediscover the UK market. I don't know. But it's very easy to put it this way. It's very easy to paint quite a negative picture about what's happening in the UK market at the moment, between the takeovers and the lack of IPOs and et cetera, et cetera. So on that somewhat gloomy prognosis, we'll call it a day there. Bobby, thanks for joining us. Absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Yuzi, thanks for coming. Thanks for turning up eventually. And thank you to all for...
Thanks for my no coffee.
Thanks for your... Well, you're too late. Thanks to all for watching and listening today. Any questions, get in touch. James.Hughes@quarterchevia.com, poppy.fox@quarterchevia.com, and I'm jonathan.raymond@quarterchevia.com, which is officially the longest email address in the world. So with that, thank you very much, and we'll see you next time.